City Talk 105.9 official podcasts online at citytalk.fm. The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Hi, welcome to Dino's download. Thanks for taking the time to get me on your iPod or your MP3 or whatever you're listening to me on. Listen, we get so many stars on The Sullivan Show, and I do mean stars, big names, celebs and the like. The other presenters get a bit jealous, I think, get a bit green. But anyway, yeah, we get that many through the doors into the studio that we've decided we're going to rename Dino's Download. We're going to rename it Sully's Starcast, and why not? We get some fantastic people. A young lady that popped into the cafe beginning of the week, a young girl called Louise English. She was co-starring with David Essex at the Empire Theatre in All the Fun of the Fair, I think it was, musical. You may not have heard her name. You'd recognise her, though. She's been in lots of things on the TV. But she had some fascinating stories to tell about Benny Hill. She worked with Benny Hill for quite a number of years and knew him pretty well, so we'll catch up with her. Also as well, Ray Quinn, of course. Our very own Ray Quinn. Good lad, isn't he, eh? Won the Dancing on Ice, as I predicted he would do, from day one. Catching up with Ray. Of course, he's going back into the West End. Rick Astley, we gave him a call to find out what he was up to. He's coming to Liverpool in the Here and Now tour. Yes, interesting story he's got to tell. And the guy, the legend, international film and movie star, local lad as well, from Liverpool, star of Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings films, to mention just two, three, four. How many Harry Potters are there now? Yeah, I'm talking about Jason Isaacs. It was great to catch up with him. Let's have a listen. This is Sully's Starcast, and this is Jason Isaacs.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Very well indeed. Of course, you hail from these shores, don't you?
I do. If I'm not very careful, I'll slip back into my Scouse accent. And then I'll go, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? Because I have no very tenuous hold on my own character, and I become whoever I'm talking to.
When did you sort of up sticks and leave Liverpool then?
1974.
Ah, right, so it's etched in your mind then.
Yeah, it was Emily. Oh, God, yeah. Well, we used to go to Anfield every week, so it was, you know.
Excellent.
It was the great days for Liverpool Football Club, unfortunately.
Well, you must. Are you still a Liverpool fan?
I am, yeah.
Disappointed this
week?
We call
them Liverpool. What we really mean is Spain. Yeah, I'm still a Spanish fan, yeah. And the other night with Chelsea was one of the most torturous nights of my life, actually.
I'm sure for many of us, Reds, indeed it was.
I was punch drunk by the end.
Were you really? Shame, never mind. Anyway, moving on. One of my colleagues, by the way, is sending his best wishes to you. One of our presenters up here, Paul Jacobs.
Yeah,
he went to school with you.
He did.
Do you remember him?
No, I don't remember anything. I was
the little fat bespeckled boy sat in the corner with his nose against the wall. That's just him. That
nice.
Was him.
I'm sure he'd be thrilled by your description as well. So my best actor.
Anyway, let's talk about good. Sure. Tell us about the film.
Well, it's a film set in the 1930s in Germany, and Viggo Mortensen plays the lead, who you may know as Aragorn in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
And he plays just a lovely guy, a good guy. That's why it's called Good. And it's about what happens to ordinary people when you're in part of a regime that you feel powerless, really, to do anything about. And, you know, growing up as a Jewish man, I've always felt that the Germans were this kind of genetic anomaly, monsters, really, and obviously thought that I could never have been those people, and I'm sure we all feel we can never be those people. When we normally watch them in movies, we think they're not only the bad guys, but they're people that we can distance ourselves from. And C.P. Taylor, who wrote the play, wanted to work out how a nation of perfectly decent people could have done these things. And so what we watch is Viggo basically doing what I've done in my life today, which is ignoring the things that their government is doing because, frankly, they feel powerless to change them. So it's a story about a guy who gradually becomes part of the Nazi regime, but really by default, by not at any point taking a stand. And what we're used to seeing in movies, of course, is taking a stand means getting a machine gun and killing the bad guys or digging a tunnel through to Austria and helping people escape. But in my life, I haven't done anything about the people we lock up without trial or the people that we torture or countries that we invade on false pretexts. I don't do anything, really, other than pontificate about a lot of the things I know are going on in my name. So the point of the story is to remind us all and challenge us all to look in the mirror and work out who are we being and what are we ignoring.
Well, why do you think, then, that we do turn our backs on so many of these things?
Because we feel powerless. And also, it's so gradual. You know, the first thing that happened, by the way, I'm a huge New Labour supporter, right?
Yeah.
To try and get them elected, and I voted for them, and I believe in many of the things that are part of their project.
Me
their project.
Too, and are you disappointed by them these days?
Well, you know, I don't care, frankly, about, you know, I think the corruption when you start charging for a bath plug and two films for a fiver each doesn't compare to the scale of corruption the Tories had by the end of the major government, and no one remembers that. But anyway, my point is, apart from the kind of expenses nonsense that fills the paper, they've also decided to do away. The first thing they did away with was the right to silence. Mm. Didn't make much of a fuss because, you know, we just had the Twin Towers and we had, you know, July the 7th in London. So they go, well, the right to silence, well, you know, bad guys shouldn't be allowed to use that. It's actually the central plank of the entire justice system. But, you know, because I studied law originally and I know how important it is that corrupt regimes can use that to get information out of you. And then we did things like, well, you can lock people up for a long time without letting them see the evidence against them. Then you can lock them up for ages without trial. And then you go, you know what? Sub the Geneva Convention, we'll take them to other countries and we'll torture them because we really need to. These are extraordinary times. Well, I haven't kicked down the doors of Downing Street. You know, I'm not marching up and down with a placard every day, nor am I packing my bags and leaving. So who am I to point the fingers at people in 1933 or 35 who didn't step in when they saw extremism and thuggery? Because I see, there was a documentary on the other day about Have a Go Heroes. And if you watched it and you've got half a brain, you realise if you see a bunch of people beating someone up in the street, you don't step forward. Because the chances are you're going to get stabbed or put in hospital. So it's all too easy to point at people and say they should have done something. And the real point of storytelling always is to provoke discussion. And all of us need to look in the mirror every day and go, where do I draw the line? You know, what am I ignoring? What am I turning my head the other way from? And what could I be doing? Is there anything I could be doing to go to bed at night and know that I've done the right thing?
Well, you mentioned that about being powerless, generally speaking. Is that what most people feel?
Most people, I think, well, look, I'll vote once every 4 years. What else am I meant to do? Do I sign online petitions? You know, I can't take homeless people home just because I've got a spare bedroom. That's madness, isn't it? You know, but I don't know what the answers are, but I do know if you stop asking the questions, then you look to Germany in the 1930s, and that's what happens when everyone goes, it's just too much for me, I'm just going to look down at my feet and ignore it all.
So this character, the main character you're talking about in the film Good, then, he gets drawn into the system. Does he put up any sort of resistance?
Well, it's not about resistance, it's about rationalising things. Look, I'm talking to you, right? I'm just looking down, I'm wearing a black T-shirt, and it was probably made in India. And it might well be made, not necessarily, but it might well be made in conditions that if I saw them face to face, I'd think were disgusting. You know, I'm talking on a microphone made in China. I know some terrible things the Chinese government does. We ignore them because we need them for trade. And we think that maybe if we keep doing business with them, we can persuade them gradually to, you know, not to execute prisoners and take their organs out and sell them on the market. But actually, that's what, you know, what Vigo's character does is rationalise. And that's what we all do. He says, if I join the party and more people like me join the party, then we'll be able to dilute the extremism. If there's a whole bunch of decent people, then we can get rid of the thugs on the right. You know, they've done a lot of useful things, but along the way, obviously they've broken some eggs, but we can get rid of the extremist tendency. And that's the kind of rationalisations that all of us use, I think, to enable us to sleep at night and look our kids in the face.
But that didn't actually happen, though, did it?
No, but they didn't know at the time. It's easy now. We look back and we go, wait a second, couldn't you see what was going to happen in 1937 and 1940? And couldn't you see the death camps were going to come in 1942? No, they couldn't. It was 1934. I've read a lot of diaries. When we were filming it, I read an awful lot of diaries. Playing a Jewish man, I'm like, why didn't he leave? You know, why didn't he get out whenever he could? Why didn't everybody leave? Well, they didn't leave because it was so insane and surreal what was happening that they couldn't believe it would last. And they had non-Jewish friends and non-Jewish business partners, and they couldn't believe these people would turn on them. They couldn't believe they'd have their businesses stolen. Then they couldn't believe they'd have their lives taken away. You know, so it all seemed too incredible, and it seemed like whatever recent law or degradation had been heaped on them would be gone soon because the international community would never let it happen.
Like you say, it's easy now for us to look back and, you know, pontificate on those sort of days. Tell us about the character of Morris, then. How does he interact in the film?
One of the great things about Morris is, you know, I've...
This is the character you play.
I play Morris, who's a Jewish psychiatrist. He's Vigo's best friend. He's a womanizer. He's a bon viveur. He's a drinker. He's a very dynamic extrovert. And he
didn't have to do much research for that then.
I had to do a lot. That's very far from me. and what the great thing is, he's so far from being a victim. He's absolutely unapologetic. He's a bit of an anti-Semite. He's entirely secular. He doesn't have any Jewish friends, or, you know. And he's a First World War veteran, as, you know, anybody who was over 30 was. You know, they'd fought in the First World War. And so there's not for a second does he question how Germany is and how much he belongs there. So when it gets to a point when his friend, his best friend who he fought with, says to him, why don't you leave? You haven't got any ties here. It's about the most offensive and insulting thing that anyone could ever say to him. He's got as many ties as anybody else. And that was a real eye-opener for me, because I have thought to myself, why didn't people leave? Well, if someone said to me, leave England, it's a ludicrous notion.
I'm talking to my special guest, Jason Isaacs, in the cafe today. I'm starring in this new film that opens in London today.
It comes to Liverpool in a couple of weeks, I think.
And in 2 weeks' time in Liverpool, yeah, we look forward to that. So Basically then, Jason, we talked about, you mentioned there about reading diaries for some of the research you did. What other research did you have to do for this sort of part?
Well, what I thought was really important is there were a whole series of, you know, unlike, I mean, there's been slaughters and kind of mass slaughters throughout history, and in Rwanda recently, and, you know, and in the Congo and in Darfur and stuff. But this was the state, and what it did was legal and scientific. So all I had to do was have a schedule of the laws. Because you shoot films out of sequence, so we go to my flat, for instance, and you shoot a scene and go, right, well, this is a scene from 1938. Okay, you've done that. It's lunchtime. Now we're doing a scene from 1934. Now we're doing 1941. So I had to have a little timeline on the wall of my caravan, my trailer, that said, okay, when you do this scene, you can no longer employ Aryans. When you do this scene, you haven't eaten meat for 3 weeks. This scene, you know, you haven't got any plumbing, electricity, or water, and you've been beaten up yesterday. This scene, you've got tons of money. And so I had to get the specific details of exactly what laws applied and exactly where I was in the timeline.
Is that difficult to jump around like that?
Well, the detail saves you. Look, acting is a weird job. I mean, you know, essentially it's just play. I've got two little girls. They're at home now playing doctors, I think. And you just have to trick your imagination into being, trying to think that you are, as far as possible, the person in the situation. So the more detail you've got, the better. Like, for instance, I play Vigo's best friend. Well, we didn't know each other. And when they were rehearsing, I wasn't available. I was doing a television series in Rhode Island. So he flew himself out to Rhode Island to come and hang out with me and my wife and kids so we could have a few days together and talk about the kinds of things we might have gone through in the First World War, so that I got there and I was shooting the scenes, we had a sense of history. Now, it's not real history, but it's as much as you can do. So I had things I listened to on the iPod, and I had pieces of music I listened to, and I had a lot of diaries that I read, and I had some objects, actually, that Vigo collected for me. He's a very sweet man. He'd driven around Eastern Europe and gone to all the camps and gone to a lot of the sites that take place in the story. And he brought back little artifacts for himself and for the other actors. And he brought some to me in Rhode Island, you know, a cigarette case he thought Morris might have had, a picture he might have had on his wall, stuff like that. And so as far as possible, I rooted myself in specifics. And then you just get in the scene and you see what your dance partner brings to it. Because, you know, all acting is about the other person. It's not about you.
Yeah, it's very interesting that. And great to have those sort of little artifacts to sort of help you with the details, as it were. So I'm just wondering, what sort of an actor are you? How do you get under the skin of a character? Are you one of those people who goes down the road of trying to become the person that you're acting?
Everybody does. There's no different types of acting. I mean, I think there's a misconception in the public eye. This word method is bandied around, but actually, all acting is pretend, and all actors do whatever they can to help their imaginations, you know, to move their imagination so they feel as far as possible like the person in the scene. I mean, you're never not aware that you can't walk over that mark, should be out of focus, or that it's the other person's turn to speak, you know.
So you've always got an eye on the technical side of things as well.
Well, you have to. You can't, you know, there's no point doing amazing acting and you're not on camera, or it's, you know, you've moved out of the light or something. So, you know, you're just trying as far as possible to put those things out of your mind so that they're second nature, like a great pianist knows where the keys are, and you're trying to let something else come through, emotions come through. So, you know, the more craft you have, the easier it is to let your imagination come through. But, you know, the notion that some people, if you want to sit all night like Daniel Day-Lewis did in a cell and have buckets of water thrown at you, or you feel like just looking at a picture, or you want to stick a drawing pin in your hand, or you just want to, you know, remember the time your dog got run over, it doesn't really matter. The point is, do whatever you can to bring your imagination to bear so that you can forget as much of yourself as possible. And so I did in this particular film, more than in most, I felt like it was an important subject. I had a responsibility because, you know, real people died, and lots of them. So I did as much of that as possible. Sometimes I just play Let's Pretend. You know, I don't know many wizards. I don't do a lot of wizard research for Harry Potter.
So Jason Good is opening in London. What's in the pipeline next?
Well, I've got some Harry Potters coming up. I've got a film called The Great Ghost Rescue, and I hope to be doing a play in the West End. And anything else that arrives through my letterbox tomorrow morning.
And Edinburgh, is that on the cards as well?
No, sadly not. I did do lots of festivals when I was young, but they don't pay any money, and I've got kids now.
Jason Isaacs, a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks a lot.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Hi, Rick.
Hi, how you doing?
Yeah, good. When was the last time you were in Liverpool?
Oh, I'd probably say last time I did a gig there, to be honest. Last year on the Here and Now, I think. Yeah, probably.
Right, so you're making a welcome return, touring around the country with this particular show.
Yeah, it goes up and down the country. It's good fun, to be honest. It's a trip down memory lane, and I did it last year, as you said, and if I'm really honest, it's pretty easy, to be honest, because you just go up there and you sing your hits, and you know, you're kind of off the stage before you're on it, kind of thing. You know what I mean? But it's good. It's a good night out.
And always get a great reception from the public. These songs are still popular, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, the Liverpool audience were fantastic last time. To be honest, I mean, obviously I'm from that sort of neck of the woods,
Manchester
area. I'm up for there, you know. So it's kind of a bit like home turf. And yeah, it's good. It's always good fun.
Is it Newton the Willows you're from originally?
Well done. Yeah, that's you've done your research. Yeah, I am. Yeah, it's about 18 miles down the East Lancs Road. Yeah.
And have you still got family there? Do you still get to see?
Yeah, I have.
Folks?
Yeah. My mum still lives there, and my sister lives still there. Yeah. So,
excellent.
Yeah.
Now this Here and Now tour that's coming to the arena. It's a great lineup, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that's one of the things that, you know, the guy who puts it together, you go there and it's a little bit like, I don't know, it's a little bit like going to a club or a disco when we were all younger and what have you, you know what I mean? It's all the songs you kind of know from your past and what have you, and I think the artists enjoy it because, like I say, because it's comfy for us because we just get up there and sing our hits, and I think the audience enjoys it because that's exactly what they get, you know. So.
And some of the people on the bill, have you worked with them before? Obviously, probably on the Here and Now tour.
Yeah,
like
one or two.
Kim Wilde.
Yeah, one or two for sure. And obviously one or two I met back in the day as well. So my experience of it last year, it's not like a kind of, it's not an ego trip for people. We all know, you know, who we are and what we are. You know, we're all comfortable with who we are as well. So it's, you know, we can all just enjoy it, really.
And, of course, the great thing is, of course, your songs, as we've said, are still popular. People still want to hear them. They want to see you get up there and strut your stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I'm actually in Athens, Georgia right now because I'm doing a music documentary, basically, about travelling across America and, you know, exploring towns that have had a song named after them and what have you. And I sang Never Gonna Give You Up in a karaoke bar because I didn't have any choice last night, you know. So, yeah, I think for different age groups, I still think it's you become part of the fabric, I think, when you've had a hit tune or two. And, yeah, you know, I appreciate that.
And that's a show that's going to be broadcast, then, is it?
We're working on that, yeah. I mean, it's something that I just wanted to do anyway, to be honest. I've always wanted to just travel across America. I've travelled across America different times, you know, with promoting records and touring and stuff, but I've never done it in my own time, and it's just something I wanted to do, and I wanted to make a documentary out of it. So.
And have you got a big following in the States, then?
I did pretty well here, yeah. I had a couple of number ones in the, you know, back in the day and what have you, and a few top 10 singles, so, yeah, I guess I'm known here, yeah, so, yeah.
And what's it like being on the road, Rick? Do you enjoy it?
To be honest, doing something like the Here and Now shows, like I say, is pretty easy because it's not very long. It's kind of a something that, to be honest, I can do in my sleep, if you know what I mean, because I know those tunes so well, and it's kind of, I just relax and enjoy it, have a bit of fun with the audience. When you're actually on a real tour, you know, and you're actually out there for weeks on end, to be honest, you know, I never really... you know, sometimes it gets a bit monotonous, you know what I mean? I know some people love it and live for it kind of thing, but for me, I missed home a lot, you know what I mean? And I wanted to have a bit more of a normal life some other time, I think.
And just going back, you started your career, came out of the famous Stock, Aitken and Waterman stable. I was reading you were discovered there as a T-boy.
Yeah, that's not strictly true, but...
Tell us the real story, then.
Yeah, well, Pete Waterman signed me to you know, to make a record, and...
Well, where did he see you? Where did he find you?
I was singing in a club in Warrington, actually, with a few different bands. We were having like a, you know, like an audition sort of night, if you like, for him. Mm. And he really liked my voice and wanted to do something with that. And so anyway, I signed a deal with him eventually. But they were making lots of records for lots of different people at the time. And so I just went down to London to hang out and ended up making tea for lots of people. And then that was the story that Pete kind of weaved into my kind of... beginning, if you like, and I think that suited the media a bit more than saying that he just signed me, you know what I mean? It seems better that he signed me from the T-boy sort of aspect.
And were you working with, you know, the likes of who were also part of that stable, the likes I'm thinking of Kylie Minogue, Jason Donovan, those?
Yeah, they came a bit after me, to be honest, just a little bit. So I did meet them, obviously, but I didn't really become friends, proper friends with anybody, to be honest, from that era, just because I just didn't, you know, and but I met them all, obviously, all the guys at Stock, Aitken & Waterman, Mel and Kim and Bananarama, all those people, made tea for a lot of those guys, you know, so
and
I
Stock,
can still make a good cup of tea. You know?
Well, I'm sure you can. Stock, Aitken and Waterman then, did you have much say in, you know, in your career?
Yes and no, really.
In what
yes.
hits you, no,
well,
not what hits, what songs you were going to sing?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, they obviously, I signed a deal with them and I knew the way they worked and I was comfy with that. But I did write, I think, four songs on my first record, and on my second one with them, I think I had a couple of singles as well. She Wants to Dance Me Whole in Your Arms, those songs I wrote. And so it was a bit of a weird one, that, because most of the people that worked with them didn't really write songs, to be honest. That wasn't really the gig, you know. But
so good to be given the opportunity to do that, because
in your
business, it's the writers who make the most money, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is over time, yeah. I mean, it wasn't necessarily, you know, that wasn't my main thought, to be honest. It was the fact that Pete Waterman then signed me to a major label, and the guy who came to listen to me sing, as it were, from the major label, he kind of picked up on a few of my songs, and he just kind of said, look, I really think Rick should be writing some of his own tunes, and that's why we did it, really, why the decision was made. It wasn't, I wasn't kind of jumping up and down saying, I want to make some money, so can I have some of my songs on there? It was just a natural thing, you know, so.
Talking to my special guest in the cafe here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool, Rick Astley, ahead of the Here and Now tour coming to Liverpool Echo Arena in May. Way back in those days when you first started with Stock Aitken and Waterman, Rick, did you ever think, do you ever believe that one day you'd end up with the best act on MTV?
No, but that was a bit of a farce, to be honest. It was a bit ridiculous. I mean, MTV,
how did it come about then?
Well, I think they put me in that category because they were being ironic and being funny, and because of this whole Rick Rolling thing that was going on that year and the year before, I think they thought it was funny to put me in that category. Because in reality, and I'm not doing myself down, I'm just being realistic, I'm not the best act ever. It's just, you know, I think they thought it was funny. And then the great British public, and European public for that matter, decided it was ironic and funny to vote for me, so they did, and I ended up winning it. But I don't, I mean, obviously, you can't, you know, I don't.
Tongue in cheek, then.
Yeah, and I don't compare myself to some of the artists that were mentioned in that category, like U2, and, you know, I mean, that you can kind of say that. I mean, Paul McCartney was at that award ceremony because he received an award and Bono gave it to him, and I can't imagine how embarrassed or ridiculous I would have felt if I would have gone to it and accepted that award. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
It was
quite deliberate then not to
absolutely,
turn up.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't want to go to it because I just felt it was... listen, it's all right and it's a bit funny and I kind of get that, but I also think for me to have been seen to actually think it and take it serious would have been quite ridiculous, you know what I mean? So.
And what about the Rick Rolling phenomenon? Where did that come
kind of
from?
Odd.
How did that... That's just sort
I don't
of took
really know
off
exactly
unbelievably.
How it happened. It's kind of credited to one guy in America, I think. I found this out recently. Who does things like this. He kind of instigates things like this on the net and creates sort of things. So I just thought, to be honest, I just thought it was some kid playing a prank on his friend kind of thing, but evidently it wasn't. It was something that somebody actually kind of moulded, if you like. And, it's a bit bizarre, a bit weird. It's a bit strange to be the Rick in Rick Rolling, but you can't knock it.
But amazing as well that it rolled around the world.
Yeah, you can't knock it. That's what's fantastic about the internet, though, isn't it, is that, you know, it's sort of, to a great degree, it's in the hands of the public, isn't it, really? You know what I mean? So that's what's great about it.
Rick, we see a lot of 80s stars, people turning up on reality TV. Ever been offered anything like that?
Yep, I get an offer through the post almost every week to do
really?
Something daft like that.
Not
yeah,
tempted?
I've no intention of doing it, no. No, not interested.
Are you not a fan of reality TV?
It's sort of entertaining at times, but generally speaking, not really. I mean, to be honest, I, you know, I'm grateful for what happened with myself in the 80s and all the rest of it, and I treat it now as a kind of, it gives me a chance to have a weekend job where I go away and sing a gig, occasionally sing at a gig, and that's the way I treat it. I've just been to South America doing a few gigs and went up to Canada and stuff, and I treat that as an absolute bonus, do you know what I mean, that I can go away and do gigs in far-flung corners of the world and just enjoy it and, you know, try and be chilled out about it and just... treat it for what it is, you know. I'm lucky to have had the life I've had, and long may it last, you know.
Are you pretty much a private person then, would you say?
Other than talking to you on the radio, yes. I guess I am, really, yeah. I do really value my privacy, and I've been fortunate enough that, you know, since my career kind of came to its end, partly because I stopped it, but, you know, I've managed.
And why was that, Rick? Why did you stop?
I'd had enough of it. I'd had 4 or 5 years of it, and that was pretty constant at the time. And I think things were changing in my life, you know, in terms of becoming a dad. And I think things were changing in the world. And
what did you want to concentrate on then, if you were not going to carry on sort of getting up and gigging?
Well, I wanted to concentrate on being a dad, to be honest, and being a family man and being there. And, you know, I knew that if I carried on doing what I was doing, I was never going to be there. And I guess that wasn't the only reason. I'm not putting it all on my daughter. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that I didn't really want to do it anymore. I wanted to have a much more normal life. And I'll be blunt, you know, I'd made a lot of money and I'd done a lot of the things that I wanted to do and ticked all the boxes, as it were. And I just thought, well, I can either do what the good boxers do and get out while, you know, they've still got their marbles and all the rest of it, or I can end up seeing where it takes me, and I may enjoy that and I may not, you know. I kind of cashed my chips in early, and I'm glad I did, you know.
Sounds like you had your feet on the ground. You know, a lot of people in the music industry, you know, get tempted by the lavish lifestyle, the drugs, the rock and roll.
I've had all that. no, but I mean, I think for some people as well, it isn't just that. I think to be honest, it's also the fact that it becomes an addiction in itself, being famous, I think, you know. And
so how easy is it to get away from that then?
Well, it takes a bit of time, you know. I mean, obviously, in my 15 minutes of fame, I was pretty famous on a fairly worldwide basis, to be honest. And, you know, I remember I used to go on holidays to far-flung corners of the world, and I'd end up singing with the hotel band because they knew my tunes, and, you know. And that's all fine, but it's... There comes a point where you just want to go on holiday and be with your family or friends or whatever, and just be on holiday. Do you know what I mean? And like I say, that was a choice that I made, and I'm glad I did. You know, most, if we're honest, most people don't get that long in pop music anyway, unless you're Madonna or someone. It doesn't really happen like that. You get your few years, and that's it. So I just quit while the going was good, I think.
Rick Astley coming to the Echo Arena in the Here and Now tour in May. Coming in May. Some of your big hits, Never Gonna Give You Up, When I Fall in Love, Rick, Together Forever, Whenever You Need Somebody. Any favourites amongst those?
Well, to be honest, they all bring a sort of a smile to my face these days because, you know, I can see in the audience the memories that they have of those songs and all the other artists who perform on the night. And I sort of probably enjoy it now more than I did back in the day, to be honest, because I've had a bit of a life, like I say now. I've had my own private life as well, and, you know, when I was having hits with those songs, I was a kid, in truth and reality, and didn't know much about myself or about the world, and now I do know a bit about those things, and I can enjoy the songs and performing them, you know, from that sort of perspective, you know. So, I still love singing Never Gonna Give You Up because I know what it means to certain people, you know.
Nice one. Well, we'll look forward to hearing you do that one, amongst many others, in May at the Arena. I'm sure you're going to have a great time in Liverpool. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
My next guest on the line into the cafe, joining me now, my old mate from Brookside, and of course, Dancing on Ice champion, Ray Quinn. How are you, Ray?
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well indeed. Did you ever imagine that you were going to win Dancing on Ice?
Oh, no, it was literally, you know, it was anybody's game, you know, from the beginning, the competition was wide open. But I can tell you, like, I absolutely loved it. It was one of the best things I've done.
Well, you could tell that you put your heart and soul into it.
Yeah, oh, well, it was just one of them things. You either go for it or, you know, that's it. All or nothing, as the Americans would
say. And what sort of training were you doing for it, Ray? Were you training sort of like, you know, 8 hours a day?
Well, not so much as that. I would say about 3 or 4 hours a day, possibly, like, especially the final, we've done about 6 hours a day. And that was including flying as well, so that's why I felt really sick, because there was so much to do.
Well, that was amazing, wasn't it? What did that feel like, doing that?
Oh, well, it was great on the show. I mean, we've done it once, and it just felt like I was glad, you know. I felt like a bit like Peter Pan.
Yeah.
But obviously, training through the week, trying to do it, was
this
really
is
hard.
The City Cafe with Dean Sullivan.
The Haymarket is Liverpool's premier New York-style restaurant, serving the city's finest char-grilled steaks, our live jazz and swing vocalists.
Just bring up your agents and invite you on.
Yeah, I auditioned for it,
right.
And they were like, oh, you know, you're a good skater, whatever, you know, are you interested? I was like, yeah, of course I am, you know, and then I didn't hear nothing for about a month, and then I got a phone call, and Georgie, my manager, and said, would you like to do it? And I was like, yeah, of course I would. And
had you been on the ice before?
No, I've maybe been like, what, 2 or 3 times to D-side, nothing major.
Nice.
But, I mean, it's just a brilliant challenge and an opportunity, isn't it, really, to skate with Chris and Jane and have Maria as a partner. I mean, she is brilliant, isn't she?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, there's no two ways about it. She helped you to the top there.
No, for sure, couldn't have done it without her.
And Chris and Jane, what were they like to work with?
Oh, great. Chris is really excitable like me, and he loves a challenge, and he's made up to see me, you know, pushed into to do things, you know, new things,
challenge
and try
it,
new
yeah.
things. Yeah, exactly. So that was really good to have that behind you and somebody pushing you.
And what were I was just going to say, what were your competitors like then? Any fierce rivalry going on?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, we were all a team because we'd literally come together from the beginning right to the end, especially like Donal and Jess and all the people who were in the final. I mean, it was literally, we all come a long way, so we had to sort of stick together really, because it was, you know, one way or the other, but yeah.
So any plans to stick with the ice skating?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I love it now. I've got that bug, you know what I mean? I really, really, really want to keep it going, for sure. I mean, it certainly keeps you fit.
Well, without a shadow of a doubt. And talking about fit as well, I was talking to the editor of Heat magazine. She's she's on every week, and she'd published pictures of you all pumped up. You've been pumping iron.
well, that bodysuit comes in handy, like, doesn't it? I go to the gym like everybody else does, you know, and try and keep fit. But it's just a passing time for me, really. But, yeah. But, so I mean, I love skating. I don't think I'll ever stop now.
Are you going to be doing that? Because it's coming on a tour, isn't it, Dancing on Ice?
Yeah, it is, and I'm so excited because, you know, because I love it so much. I feel like it's great that I get the chance to relive it all, you know.
So will you be doing new routines for the tour, or will you just be repeating
what
you've
done? No, we'll be doing the ones that we did on the show, yeah. But,
great.
I mean, we start on the 2nd of April in Sheffield, And then we go all the way. We were in Manchester. Unfortunately, not coming to Liverpool.
I was going to say, not coming to the arena now.
I'm gutted, I'm gutted, absolutely gutted. They went last year.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they're not going this year, but I'm so upset, yeah.
Well, all your Liverpool fans will come over to Manchester. It's not that far away.
Oh, well, I hope so. But I just want to say now, while we're live, thanks very much to whoever who voted for me in Liverpool. I mean, everybody knows I miss Liverpool.
We were flying the flag for you, Ray. You know, we were all here at the top of the tower saying, I said it from the beginning, I said, Ray Quinn's going to win that competition. Telling you now.
Oh, well, thank you anyway.
Do you think as well, Ray, do you think your dancing background helped with it as well?
Well, that's what I thought. I thought I'd get a bit of an advantage there, but, do you know, once you put a bit of... you can ask any choreographer out there who says, oh, you're a choreographer Dancing on Ice or people who skate, you know, and it's so different, and I have to literally retrain myself out of what I normally would do, because you can literally dance more with your top half than your bottom half, so you've got to compensate. I mean, it's really complicated, but, yeah, I have to completely retrain myself, but I got there in the end.
Did you end up with any bruises and sprains?
Oh, aye, we all had our fair share of bruises and falling over. But, yeah, I mean, you know, you just got to get up and carry on, really, haven't you? Get back on the horse. But at the end of the day, if you're not falling over, you know, you're not learning.
Yeah. Now, what's on the cards next? You're doing the tour, and I noticed I was reading something in the paper the other day. You're doing pantomime, aren't you, for Kudos?
Yeah, I'm going back at the end of the year. Well, I'm doing panto at the end of the year, in Birmingham Hippodrome, and I'm playing Prince Charming in Sleeping Beauty with Joe Pasquale.
Oh, brilliant. I know Joe. He's great. You'll have a great time with Joe.
Yeah, I can't wait. And I'm also, after the tour, going back to Greece, so...
Yeah, you're going to be playing the lead part in that, aren't you?
Yeah, they give me Danny Zuko, which, dream part for me, always since a little boy.
Is that back in the West End, is that right?
Yeah, it is. Me open night, the 11th of May.
Fantastic. Great. You're doing really, really well. What are the dreams and ambitions have you still got left, Ray?
Oh, I've got plenty, mate. Yeah, you know, there's so many things out there I'd love to try and do, but, I mean, I'm just taking each step as it comes, you know, and I'm a big believer in faith, and whatever's meant for me won't pass me by, but, I mean, I'm just so good. We're not coming to Liverpool on tour, really good, but...
It's a shame, but you'll be back soon, I'm sure, in something.
Yeah, but my mum and dad are still there, and all my family and stuff, and I'm trying to get back as much as I can, but obviously, with being in London and stuff, it's pretty hard.
Okay, now, I was asking you there, you know, what's on the cards next. Are we likely, do you think, ever to see you in something like Celebrity Big Brother, or I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, The Jungle?
I don't know, really. Probably not Big Brother. I don't know. I just don't feel like that's my thing, but I think Celebrity would be quite fun, you know. I wouldn't mind going out there. There's no way I could eat them bugs. Like, you know, I don't know what I'd do, but it would be quite a good experience, even just to get out there and jump out the plane. That'd be quite cool.
Well, I'm sure whatever you did there, you put your heart and soul into it.
I hope so.
Everyone here in Liverpool proud of you. Congratulations again for being a Dancing on Ice champion. What did you actually get? Did they give you a trophy? They did, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
Did you get to
trophy.
Keep that? Did you get to, is
oh,
that yours?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's mine, yeah.
You have to get your mum to put it on the mantelpiece.
I know. But I want to give it to Maria, like, as well, but I think we're going to try and share it, because I'm really proud of her and us as a partnership.
Excellent. Well, once again, Ray, lovely talking to you, as always. Congratulations, and we'll see you soon.
Oh, well, thank you, Dean. Lovely to hear a Scouser.
Take it easy.
Take care. Bye.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
So, listen, part of your... Well, let's just see if our listeners can... this is part of your career. We'll come back to it.
Okay.
Let's give them a clue.
Right.
You hear that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, did that bring back some happy memories?
Oh, very happy memories.
Benny Hill, how were you involved with Benny then? Were you on the TV show?
Yes, I did his television shows up until 1986.
Were you one of those
81.
Girls running around the field in bra and
I was 16 when I first met him. He formed a group called Hill's Angels about a year or two after I was in the show. And I was doing all the sketches with him and sang on the shows with him. And he used to write things for me to do with him, which was great.
And what was he? What was he actually like as a man? Because you know, you hear all these stories that he died on his own in a little flat somewhere with
about
bags of money
time
under
of the year
the,
it was it? As well. Easter. Yeah. He was a very, very lovely, sensitive man, a very private man who I think was actually frightened of being hurt by people.
Really?
So he went into sort of gradually, not reclusive, but he just kept himself with the people that he knew and loved. And I can quite understand that now. Now I'm older, I can. At the time, I thought, oh, he's always on his own, bless him. And he loved his mum and dad. He loved his close family. But, yeah, he wasn't reclusive. And he died very... He was a happy, happy, successful man.
And when he was successful, he was highly successful. I mean, these days, it's a shame that, you know, his sort of... that genre of comedy that he was, you know, the master of... is sometimes frowned upon these days, you know.
Do you think it still is, or is other things to frown upon now? I think there is, isn't there, really?
Yeah.
Like people playing tricks on radio shows and things. I think that's worse. I think that kind of behaviour... I mean, the old school, the Morecambe and Wise, Benny Hill, they were all such gentlemen and such lovely... I'm so privileged that I remember meeting them. You know, when I was 16, I was just a baby starting out, and I just remember everyone being so lovely to one another, and Eric Morecambe would shake Benny by the hand and say, "Well done, Benny, we're so thrilled for you that your show's done so well in America." And Benny would say, "Well, thank you very much, sir." And this great respect was just fantastic.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. My special guest in the cafe this hour is the star of one of the stars from All the Fun of the Fair, alongside David Essex. I'm joined by Louise English. Yes, a gentleman, but, you know, I can remember reading after he died, we're talking about Benny Hill that you starred with all those years ago as well. You know, when he died, they found uncashed cheques in his flat from TV series and things.
Yeah, Dennis was there with him, found. He was on his own at Easter because it was only Easter, and he'd been to see me and my girl on the Wednesday, which was just prior. He died on the Sunday, and he came to see the matinee, and I was in it with Les Dennis, who's from Liverpool, as you know, and Benny wanted to have a picture taken with me, which is something he never used to do. He was always very private and quiet, but he insisted on a photo shoot that I had to organise, which I thought was a bit odd. But looking back,
what was it for then?
Just he wanted a picture with me.
Right.
I didn't know what it was for. He just said, "Get the publicity people in." And he came in and we had pictures taken, and Les was there and Les to add the pictures. And they were the pictures that they used when Benny died on the Monday morning. Now, I don't know whether he knew he was going to die or whether he was obviously feeling very ill and he had a very bad heart problem. Whether or not he was told, I don't know. But he wouldn't leave my dressing room. He didn't want to go. And, you know, at the half-hour call, half an hour before the show, the company manager's coming in. "All right, Miss English, your guests will have to go now." And he had no intention of going.
And what did he do?
He stayed until the five-minute call.
Right.
And he very reluctantly left. And
yeah,
he
because
was
if
like
people
a dad
don't know,
to me, you see. I grew up with him.
That is unusual if people don't know listening. You know, backstage, you know, there's all those rituals. Yes, people have to be out of the dressing room by 5 to 7.
Yes, it's the rule,
you know,
isn't
for
it?
For the half, yeah. Mm.
And
so, yeah, sorry, you said he was like a dad to you.
Yeah, he was. So when I said goodbye to him, I felt really... I knew there was something not right. I knew there was something wrong. But I couldn't... I just kept thinking, oh, well, it'll be fine. We'll get Easter over and... You know, it's like when you're on a show, it's not that you're flippant, it's just that you have to go on stage, you have to, you're called to. You can't just say, "Oh, I think I'd like the night off, please, can I go off with Benny for something to eat?" Because I was a bit worried about him, but I couldn't, I had to stay and do the show. And he was very happy, though, because he'd been given a contract with Central Television and he was going to do a new series because, you know, he was sacked from Thames and he had Dennis Kirkland.
How did he react to that?
took it very well. I was furious for him.
Benny Hill, he was with Thames for a long time, wasn't he?
32 years or something, wasn't it?
Amazing.
Yeah. And he was just called into the office and just on it, and they insisted that he went in on his own and said, we don't want your agent with you or the director with you. And he just thought it was to do another promo for the South of France, because I think he just picked up an award for Cannes Film Festival.
Why do you think they did make this decision?
Well, I think it was the controller's wife, who was a bit of a snob, and said, oh dear, can't have all that, those girls running about, it's not on. And this, you know, you become out of favour, don't you, as a comedian, which I think he accepted. You know, you have your day, and he had his own show for 45
and
years.
And Benny Hill, he wasn't just about chasing scantily dressed girls around a field.
No, he used to write marvellous monologues.
And create great characters as well.
Yeah, but it was, as you say, it was that sort of press attention and that media sort of pressurising, I think, just on the girls running around. And actually, when you see the shows, it was just kind of a tiny clip of that sometimes. But he was a great loved comedian, and he was huge in America. And his show went 70 countries around the world, which I still get, you know, repeat money from. And it's still a great interest from America. Mm. I still get lots of letters. And he was absolutely enormous. And Michael Jackson was desperate to meet him. And everybody, Liza Minnelli, Burt Reynolds, they all wanted to be in the show. They wanted to do anything in the show. They wanted to run around at the end with the girls at the end, just to do anything on it. So to be in something that was so phenomenally large, he was just so quiet and so sweet about it.
So Louisa must have been a huge... You were very close to him, obviously,
yeah,
from what you said.
Close,
and
yeah.
So it must have been a terrible shock to find out that he died.
Terrible shock. I've heard it on the radio going home. Terrible shock, yeah.
How did it all start for you? Were you always interested in becoming an actress, a singer?
Yes,
treading
I'm afraid
the boards.
I was,
yes.
Because my mother was, and so yes. was my father, a musician in the
well,
orchestra.
Well, tell us about your mum and your dad. Yes, so
well,
you...
she was a beautiful. She had a beautiful singing voice, and my mum was in the Evening Stars with Leslie Crowther, and they used to do summer season shows. And there was one year she was at the Winter Gardens, and Benny was at the Lido with Reg Varney. And I think my mum was only 17 or 18, and he was in love with someone that was in my mum's show, or something had happened, and there was a romance going on, but she turned him down, and Benny was very upset. So I think my mum took him out for egg and chips and a cup of tea to cheer him up. So they sort of had a great respect for each other and knew each other. But Bob Monkhouse was there as well, writing shows, and it was a great kind of union they had, really. Mum said she always knew he was going to do well. He always thought he would just be a writer. You see, he wrote all these scripts and took them to the BBC when he was very young. He was about 27. And the man said, always, we'd like to do the shows. And he said, well, who do you think would be able to do them? And the controller of the BBC said, you, Mr. Hill, we're going to give it to you. And he went, my goodness gracious. So that's how he got his own show.
Wow.
In the 50s, yeah. Oh, he was lovely. You'd have loved him.
Yeah.
He was just great fun and just a lovely, normal guy. And the money, you see, you mentioned the checks. Well, the money wasn't important to him. He used to give a lot of it away, a lot of it to charities and a lot of it. He had two.
Do you still miss him?
Oh, terribly, I do, yeah.
Mm. I mean, you mentioned just earlier, you know, you said, and it was this time of the year when he passed away. So it's one of those things always comes back to you.
Mm.
What are some of your, let's not be miserable, what are some of your favourite parts? You've done a lot. I've just been reading through, skimming through your CV, as we call it there, and you've done lots of musicals and shows, haven't you?
And lots of plays. I try and balance them up with plays as well, because you know
any
what
preference?
It's like, you're an actress.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you do too much singing, then she's not an actress, so you've got to always keep proving yourself that you can act, which is exhausting. And I think I've spent my whole career proving I can do it from the age of 16, particularly having been on the Benny Hill show. It's all what people want to talk about or remember you by. So you have to balance it up with a few bits of Shakespeare and bits and bobs.
Absolutely. Any favourite roles?
All of them. I can honestly say I like this one at the moment because it's the first time I'm playing a very hard woman. And I think it's the first time I come on stage not smiling.
And isn't it great to be given the opportunity to create a brand new character?
Yes, wonderful. That doesn't happen very often.
Well,
it doesn't,
especially in the world of musicals as well, because very often you'll have people say, oh, I saw so-and-so and such a thing, but she wasn't as good as such, because they make that comparison.
Of course they do. Like when I did Me and My Girl, there were so many Me and My Girls before me, Emma Thompson being one of them.
Of
but doing something so marvellous as this is that, yes, you are, and you're on the CD first, because it's the first thing that, you know, that they're doing. And David's thinking of filming it too,
wow,
which would be amazing. But I must say, working with him has been an absolute pleasure and delight.
Well, Louise, it's been an absolute pleasure and delight talking to you.
Thank you.
You're at the Empire till Saturday.
Saturday,
yeah.
Yes.
And
please come
how
and
did
see
it go? I will do. I will do. And we'll go for a drink later on.
We
as
got
well.
A great
how
night
did
last
it,
night.
Yeah, good first night.
Standing up.
Brilliant. That's
well,
what
I
we
love.
Love
Liverpool.
The Empire.
Liverpool,
yeah,
down.
They're great audiences down there. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Louise.
Thank you.
Thanks for popping in.
Listen, and log on to the Voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.